You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 21st of September 2017 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily, in association with UBS. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to the Monocle Daily here on Monocle 24 with me, Paul Osborne. Coming up in the programme, Donald Trump slaps more sanctions on North Korea as he moves closer to scrapping the nuclear deal with Iran. We'll ask whether it risks sending mixed messages to the world. Meanwhile, the US may be about to become even more isolated on the issue of climate change, with Nicaragua set to sign up to the Paris Accord. As Germany's election draws nearer, we'll assess the wider impact the far right has had on the country's campaign. And later, as Google spends more than $1 billion buying a mobile tech firm, we'll try to figure out why.
Android used to be the Wild West. It's more controlled now, but it's still not as rigorous, perhaps, in some ways, as Apple is. So I think that's why the apps, if they are better on Apple phones, are better.
Plus, vegan food in Amsterdam, the top stories from across Asia, and the heartbreak behind the tango. All in the next hour on the Monocle Daily, live from London on Monocle 24. First of all, though, look at some of the day's other top stories. Rescuers in Mexico say they are losing hope of finding more survivors in the rubble of a school which collapsed after an earthquake. They've been trying to reach a girl trapped in the building, but say they are no longer looking for her. They do think that at least one adult remains alive in the rubble. At least 230 people died in the quake. Mexico's president has declared 3 days of national mourning for the victims. At least 15 people are known to have died after Hurricane Maria struck Dominica. But the Prime Minister says it is a miracle the death toll wasn't higher. Homes and schools have been destroyed, telecommunications cut, and the island's main hospital is still without electricity. Spain's constitutional court is imposing daily fines of €12,000 on top Catalan officials for every day they continue efforts to stage an independence vote. It's after more than a dozen Catalan politicians were arrested yesterday as the government in Madrid tries to stop the vote, which has already been declared illegal. And the world's richest woman, Lilian Bettencourt, has died at the age of 94. The heiress to the cosmetics firm L'Oreal was said to be worth $40 billion. A statement says she died peacefully at home. It was her father who founded a hair dye company in 1909, which became the L'Oreal Group, which is now the world's largest cosmetics company. Well, welcome to tonight's Monocle Daily. First of all, it's been another busy week for Donald Trump with a trip back to his native New York, where he delivered an address at the United Nations that was every bit as calm and statesmanlike as you might expect. When he wasn't threatening to totally destroy North Korea, he was dismissing the Iran nuclear deal as an embarrassment. Well, tonight, the president signed a new order widening sanctions against Pyongyang. Meanwhile, a special counsel investigating Trump appears once again to be widening the scope of his inquiries. Well, joining me to discuss all this is David Osborne, U.S. correspondent for The Independent. David, let's begin with North Korea. Who do these new sanctions target?
Basically, anybody that has any dealings with North Korea, I think they are thinking transport companies, ships, airplanes, but also financial institutions above all. If they've had any dealings with North Korea in the last half a year, I think is the time scale, they will not be allowed to do business in the US. They won't be able to tie up their ships in the US, do any banking with the US. But basically, it's another attempt by Washington to punish anybody still doing business with North Korea and therefore punish North Korea itself. And I think that after the rather shocking speech by Donald Trump you referred to on Tuesday, when he spoke of totally destroying not just a regime but an entire people, some people, I suppose, may take some consolation from the fact that, you know, 2 days later the US is back focusing on sanctions and diplomatic levers to try and resolve this question. And we also had Trump claiming, at least at the UN this afternoon, that China's central bank is now taking what, if this is true, would be really quite serious steps itself to suck the oxygen out of the North Korean economy by ordering its enormous network of subsidiary banks to cease doing business with any North Korean entities or the North Korean state. Now, if that's true, that could be an important step. So at least we've shifted from bombs to economic measures, which is, I guess, a cause for some sigh of relief.
If the purpose of the rhetoric and the sanctions and everything else is to drag North Korea to some sort of negotiating table, how does that sit with the United States, with the president seemingly being so keen to tear up the deal that was negotiated with Iran?
Well, that's a question that a lot of people at the UN have been asking this week, notably most of the European Union officials. You know, make the rather obvious point that seems to have escaped Donald Trump, that if you expect North Korea to enter into negotiations for a deal, and North Korea looks at him simultaneously attempting to tear up a deal that's already been done with Iran, you know, what is the incentive for Pyongyang to play any kind of ball? It is odd. I mean, I think what the White House sees it the other way about. It says, if North Korea sees that Iran is getting away with murder, which is what they seem to think this deal has done for them, then it will only encourage North Korea to misbehave also. So you can see there are two sort of entirely opposing views of this equation. It's a point well taken.
Now, he's called the Iran deal an embarrassment, but he's also apparently considering giving Congress the decision of whether to keep the deal or get rid of it.
Well, that wouldn't be the first time that he's booted something to Congress to deal with. I mean, he's a little bit trapped, Trump, because scrapping the Iran deal, the worst deal ever made in the history of humanity, was something he repeated over and over again on the campaign trail. And so he's obviously decided he can't just ignore it, whatever he is being advised by officials around him. I suspect that people like Rex Tillerson, the U.S. Secretary of State, would not like to see it torn up, and I know that the Europeans wouldn't. I mean, I had someone say to me yesterday, they're far more afraid of Trump torpedoing the Iran deal and what that might trigger than they're afraid of what's going on with North Korea, because Iran has such a capacity to move forward if the restraints that this deal has put upon it are removed. So there's a tremendous amount of nervousness. My guess is that the Trump will fall halfway between, or maybe Congress will do it for him, and seek some kind of renegotiation, some kind of recasting of the treaty, notably extending the time period during which these constraints would remain in place on Iran. Would that be easy, however? No, it wouldn't. It would be a nightmare. But then no one expected Trump to be elected and things to be easy.
Well, meanwhile, Robert Mueller is now looking not just at the Trump campaign, but also at some of the big events of the first year in the Trump White House.
Yes, that's very interesting, isn't it? It's quite tantalizing, this whole Robert Mueller investigation. Almost every day we hear reports that indicate, you know, the sheer scope of this. And as you indicate, we now know that Robert Mueller has been asking for documentation and other records directly from the White House. Just a minute ago, I learned that among the things he's asked for are records of conversations that happened aboard Air Force One when Mr. Trump was attempting to help his son, Donald Jr., compose an explanation of the meeting he had with a Russian lawyer in Trump Tower last year. We know that he's now seeking documentation with respect to the firing of former FBI Director James Comey, with respect to the firing and the handling of the whole Michael Flynn situation before he was eventually removed moved. Well, I say eventually, it was only 3 weeks into the administration, but it had been known for some time in the administration that he was in legal trouble for having lied about contacts with Russian officials. We're hearing they want documentation about a meeting that Donald Trump had with Russian officials in the White House, where he spoke of firing Comey, and what a relief he thought that was. So that, and also in parallel, increasing volumes of information regarding the focus of Mueller on Paul Manafort, the former campaign chairman. You know, this investigation is by no means fading away or drifting off into the mists. We don't know how long is longer we're going to have to wait for concrete action from Mueller, but I think it's pretty clear by now that that something is coming, and it's not just going to be incidental to Donald Trump. It's going to be right on his shoulders.
And at the beginning of the appointment of the special counsel, the president sent this sort of flurry of fairly angry tweets, but he seems to have calmed down a bit lately. But presumably the more the scope of the investigation widens, the more likely there'll be another explosion.
Well, of course, since that time, John Kelly has become his chief of staff, General Kelly. And, you know, you notice that since he's been in charge, which basically since the end of July, there hasn't been a cessation of Donald Trump's tweets by any manner of means. But there have been a few less that are totally incendiary and counterproductive for him, and certainly less from him whining and whinging and complaining about the investigation. And I suspect that the message has finally got through to him that that's an extremely bad idea, since part of what's being investigated is his attempts to, or possible alleged attempts to, undermine the investigation. So he's clearly been told to shut up about it. But yes, I mean, you know, there is a feeling here that, you know, you poke the bear that is Trump, and it's a dangerous game, because he's apt to then do and say things that are rather dangerous.
Well, it's good to see that John Kelly is having an impact at the Times, at least, when he doesn't have his head in his hands like he did at the UN this week.
yes,
David, we'll have to leave it there, but thanks very much for your time this evening. That's David Osborne from The Independent. You're listening to Monocle 24. Now, having looked to be on a knife edge a few months ago, Germany's elections this coming weekend now look, well, perhaps a little bit dull. Angela Merkel looks certain to continue a leadership that's already lasted for 12 years. Her Christian Democrats far ahead of their nearest rival. But below the surface, there could still be a few shocks on the way. As campaigning enters its final phase, let's talk to Matthew Konitschnig, who's the chief Europe correspondent for Politico, based in Berlin. Matthew, let's start with Mrs. Merkel and her CDU. How did the race go from being neck and neck to apparently barely being in doubt?
Well, I mean, you have to remember that it's a very short campaign, in fact. It's only about a month. And in that time, over the past 4 weeks, we've seen the far right party in particular gradually strengthen. And in fact, tonight there was another poll that came out that showed that the AfD, as the party is called, the Alternative for Germany, is at about 11%, which is significantly better than where they were a month ago. And what's happened is that because people thought that Merkel was basically inevitable, and all of the other mainstream parties that are in the running are willing to cooperate with her more or less in some kind of a coalition, anybody who does not like Merkel, who does not accept her policy on refugees, for example, doesn't really have much of an alternative except for this Alternative for Germany. So that has made the race somewhat more interesting in this final week, I would say.
So the AfD are certainly poised to be the first ultra-nationalist, I suppose, party in the German parliament since the 1950s. But as with a lot of other elections in Europe, I suppose the real impact of those far-right parties, it's not the party itself, it's the way that it drags the other mainstream parties onto its agenda. And you've seen the mainstream parties in Germany step up sort of anti-immigrant sentiment.
Well, you've seen them sort of shift slightly to the right on some issues. I wouldn't say anti-immigrant sentiment necessarily, but you've seen even Angela Merkel's party, the Christian Democrats, really take a 180-degree turn in terms of its refugee policy over the past couple of years. I mean, if you look at it now compared to the days in 2015 where she was welcoming the refugees, it's a pretty stark contrast. And that is largely because of the pressure that the conservatives have felt in Germany by the AfD. And it's also true of the Free Democrats, the Liberal Party, which has also been polling fairly well in recent weeks. So you could see that the far right is already having an impact on the German political landscape. And certainly if they finish third, as some people fear now on Sunday, that will send a very clear message to the rest of Europe and to the rest of the world, indeed, about what the atmosphere in Germany is at the moment.
You mentioned it's an extraordinary turnaround for Angela Merkel from sort of throwing the borders open to adopting much, much tougher policies on this issue. But equally, politically, she's going to win. She isn't going to pay a heavy price for it.
Well, that's right. She's going to win. The question is, you know, how high her tally is at the end of the day. As I say, a month ago they were at around 40%. Now they're in the 35 to 36% range. It might make it more difficult for her to form a coalition at the end of the day because the party has weakened a bit. She certainly won't have improved the CDU-CSU's result compared to 2013 in the last election when they got over 40%. So this is probably going to be her last term. So the fact that, you know, the party's acceptance has weakened is not going to make that last term easier. Certainly if the far right is also in the parliament and if they are the lead opposition party, which is a real prospect now, because the party that comes in third on Sunday will in all likelihood be the lead of the opposition, which gives them certain privileges and certainly a kind of stature, a stage, if you will, that will allow them to attack Merkel from all sides.
You mentioned that Angela Merkel is going to have to form some sort of a coalition. There have been reports that it could take anything up to 3 months to hammer out an agreement.
That's right. I think that all of the potential partners out there are going to draw this out as long as possible. And I think most people here in Berlin think that at the end of the day, there'll be another grand coalition, a coalition between Merkel's center-right conservative bloc and the Social Democrats. But before they get to that point, she's going to have to try and form a coalition with the Liberals, with the Free Democrats, as they're called here, and with the Greens. But there's a lot of conflict between those parties, and as a result, there's a lot of skepticism about whether that will succeed. So by December, you might be looking again at a grand coalition as being the only viable option.
Matthew, thanks very much. Matthew Koenigsegg is Politico's chief Europe correspondent based in Berlin. You're listening to The Daily from Monocle 24.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Pack your bags and join us on a global tour through exciting and inspiring cities. From Madrid to Miami, Tokyo to Toronto, we've created travel guides that will help you get the best out of a city, no matter how short your stay. We'll whirl you around some of our favorite architectural spots, top cultural haunts, and then point you in the direction of a well-earned drink from a little-known cocktail bar. We've also scouted the prettiest running routes, the most design-savvy shops, and the best hotels to comfortably rest your head. View our full range of travel guides at monocle.com or visit any good bookstore and plan your next escape today. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
Now, it's only a few days since the White House insisted that its desire to pull out of the Paris Climate Change Accord was undimmed, despite reports that it was close to changing its mind. If the US does go ahead, it could now be even more isolated with the news that Nicaragua is set to sign up to the international agreement to curb greenhouse gas emissions. Well, joining me now is Antonia Sampau, who's a research associate for security and development at the International Institute for Strategic Studies. Antonia, Nicaragua's president initially said he wouldn't sign up to the Paris Accord. So why has he changed his mind?
Well, Nicaragua was very isolated for being the, alongside Syria initially, was the only country, they were the only countries that did not sign the agreement after negotiating it. The U.S. actually signed the agreement, but has later withdrawn with Trump's decision. So it was suffering a lot of international damage to its image. But also what changed now is that Nicaragua's argument to rejoin the agreement is that it has come to see the damage that is being done to many poor countries. Maybe the hurricanes in the Caribbean now have had an influence on that, and also its position alongside Syria in the U.S. In not being part of the agreement. So it's saying that it's joining out of solidarity to many of the poor countries like the small island nations that are suffering the most with climate change and climate-related events, but its position on the what it calls the unfairness of the agreement remains.
It's interesting in a way that Nicaragua didn't sign up at the beginning, because it's one of the countries where renewable energy is a bit of a success story.
Yes, over 50% of its energy is renewable. It is a position that has to do with sort of internal and foreign policy positions of being aligned with a pro-developing country and having a narrative of developed countries imposing imperialism, imposing positions on the poor countries. So the sort of unfairness of the international structure that countries like Nicaragua, like Venezuela and Iran want to revise. So this position has fed its narrative of let's not sign this agreement because the developed countries who are responsible for over 70% of emissions of carbon dioxide are not paying sufficiently or proportionately the costs of the climate adaptation.
And now if the Nicaraguans do sign up, as you say, that leaves Syria outside the deal. And then if the United States does pull out, that's the US and Syria, which is a curious combination.
Very much.
Would that not have any bearing on the United States to find itself in a slightly odd club of Donald Trump and Bashar al-Assad?
Well, if you, I think that this answer depends greatly on who you ask inside the U.S., because obviously I am sure that several State Department, Defense Department, Department for Energy, people are extremely, extremely distressed at the thought of being left outside the Paris Agreement and being alongside Syria in anything. But the position of the Trump administration seems to me as an internal position. They are playing for their internal audience almost entirely in doing that. And the main argument has been that the adaptation that is required for their industries and the economy is going to cost. That is correct. There is a cost to adapting to climate change and to cleaner energies, but that this cost is not proportional or that is unfair to impose that on people currently suffering from poverty or being the lower middle class, and that taking care of these people now is more important than adapting to the potential catastrophic damage of climate change.
As other countries continue to push forward this, with Nicaragua signs up and European countries saying that they're going to stick to it, and obviously the US coming under pressure, Donald Trump coming under pressure at the UN General Assembly this week. But without the United States, if it does go ahead and pull out, is there a risk that the whole accord could just slowly unravel, with other countries saying, well, why should we go through this pain, this expense, if the world's richest and most powerful country can't be bothered?
I think the risk of that happening because of the US is relatively low, because I think there is a broad international understanding that the current administration in the US is very atypical, and that many of the positions, especially a position regarding an agreement that has such a long-term effect, implication, and maturing time, is potentially transitory. So future administrations might be willing to join again the Paris Agreement. The greatest threat to the Paris Agreement, I think, is the financing of developing countries to adapt. So if there is a position in the agreement that says that developed countries commit to provide $100 billion per year to developing nations, however, there isn't much clarity on what these what form this money could take. So it could be loans, it could be donations, but proving that this money went precisely for climate adaptation is difficult to pinpoint. So if the developing countries eventually find that this is not working out and developed countries are not fulfilling their promises, this could be an existential threat to the agreement.
Antonia, thank you very much. Antonia Sampaio is a research associate at the International Institute for Strategic Studies. You're listening to Monocle 24. Well, next to some big purchases in the tech sector, where Google has confirmed it's bought a part of HTC's mobile design and engineering team for $1.1 billion. That announcement followed the acquisition of Toshiba's memory chip business by a group that included Apple. So what lies behind these big moves by the tech giants? Well, earlier, Henry Rhys Sheridan spoke to Monocle's technology correspondent, David Phelan.
HTC is a Taiwanese company that has been around for a lot longer than people know, because they used to make phones for other companies. They're what we call a white label phone company, and they made several firsts, including the first Google phone, which they made for T-Mobile initially, and lots of other firsts. They did so well that they became emboldened to use their own name, and suddenly, in the early 2000s, had a big hit with several phones and became a very big player. They had 10% of the market at one point, and then it didn't stick. During that time, they bought an excellent design company based in San Francisco, and their design, I have to say, ever since has been one of the strongest, absolutely on a par with Nokia, perhaps occasionally even with Apple. But they haven't been able to shift phones to the extent that they've liked ever since.
So now Google has bought part of HTC, the excellent design team that you mentioned, and the engineering team for $1.1 billion. What kind of experience and expertise are they getting for that price?
They're getting a lot of design and certainly research and development expertise. These are people who learnt before almost anyone else did the importance of making the joins between, say, the glass on the front of your phone and the plastic or metal on the back as smooth so you could almost not feel it. And that was one of the things that made their phone so well liked. And they continue to innovate. Their latest phone this year is called the U11. It has squeezy sides so that you can take a photograph just by squeezing it, or you can do other things with that as well. That didn't take off quite as well as it should have done, not least because when you squeeze a phone, you kind of slightly shake it, which isn't what you want when you're taking a photograph. But they've continued to put strong components and cutting-edge design into their phones. So all of that will be very useful to Google, especially as it's beginning to make its own range of phones, currently the Pixel.
Well, I was going to ask, Google are best known as one of the world's biggest software companies. Why are they acquiring such a premium hardware company?
Sure. Well, one of their big pieces of software is Android, the operating system for most of the mobile phones in the world, which they give away free and have always given away free. And they've in more recent years taken greater control over it. It used to be that Motorola or Sony or Samsung could do whatever they wanted with that that software. Now they have much greater restrictions. And then last year they released their own designed hardware and software phone, the Pixel and the Pixel XL. And on October the 4th this year, they'll be releasing the sequels to that. To have a company like HTC, who have been involved, in fact, they built the first Pixel for them, will be very useful for Google.
One interesting aspect of this story is that the announcement that this deal had been made came at almost exactly the same time as confirmation that Toshiba's memory chip business had in fact finally been acquired by a group including Apple. And we spoke to you about this last week. And one thing that you mentioned is that Apple's acquisition of this part of Toshiba might be a sign that the company is moving away from its traditional model of having an extremely tightly integrated production, taking responsibility for the production of almost all its parts, and beginning to outsource some of this activity. I wonder, is this Google kind of moving in the other direction, trying to bring more manufacturing capability under its umbrella?
Absolutely. I think that's the key differentiator for Apple from everyone else, is they make the hardware and the software. BlackBerry did for a while, but and Microsoft when they bought Nokia, that was the case as well. But if you have that hardware and software control, then you can do what you like. And that's why Apple's phones have always been a walled garden. That's why it's so difficult for people once they've got into the Apple world to easily leave, because all their contacts and apps and everything else are in there. Google doesn't quite have that same capability with Android phones, because if you have a Sony Android phone, you can switch to a Samsung one or a Motorola or whoever, or an HTC, quite easily, because the operating system is the same across all of them. If you're then making the hardware as well as the software, then you can begin to take more control and keep people loyal.
Another factor complicating Google's hardware ambitions is the fact that Google already makes a lot of app for Apple's iOS operating system. Some people say that they make better apps for iOS than they do for Android, their own operating system. Is there a risk that they could end up formulating a conflict of interest here?
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I think the interesting thing is that if that's true, and I think it certainly is in some cases, it's because the Apple framework into which those apps have to fit is so coherent and so strong that the apps that come out of it are very good. Android used to be the Wild West. It's more controlled now, but it's still not as rigorous, perhaps, in some ways, as Apple is. So I think that's why the apps, if they are better on Apple phones, are better. That doesn't mean that Google can't create apps as good for their own system. It's just that they haven't got round to it. And you have to remember, this is historically because Apple Maps, when it used to be run powered by Google, and early Apple said, no, we've got our own mapping app. And it was a disaster, an unmitigated disaster. It's way better now. It's good. It's very good. But Google were determined with their mapping app, when they got back onto the platform, that they were going to make the best mapping app there is. So I think that it stemmed from a kind of a determination to beat Apple at its own game. And you're right, they are doing it in other apps as well.
And that's Monocle's technology correspondent David Phelan speaking to Henry Rees Sheridan. To food next, because while vegan cuisine may be old news in many major cities, it is a relative newcomer in Amsterdam. In part, that's because the vegan lifestyle is not necessarily compatible with the meat and cheese heavy Dutch diet. But now a new crop of restaurants is trying to change all that, as Monocle's Amsterdam correspondent Renisha Rainey has been finding out.
I'm at Vegan Junk Food Bar, a new diner-style place where everything is plant-based. The food is served on trays, and the music is loud. Perched at one of the high tables is Anna. She's not a full-time vegan, yet, but she did stop eating meat a month ago. This is her second time here.
What did we order? The loaded fries, the truffle fries, the onion rings, and the bitterballa.
And how is it? I think it's great. It's not the same, but it is great. And it's not like you miss any animal products like cheese.
From shawarma to burgers to chicken nuggets, plus a side of chips, of course, everything here is an animal-free version of the fast food classics. Papine is the head chef.
It's everything you know, but plant-based and better, and it's just everything you want on like a rainy Saturday afternoon.
What's people's reactions been?
They're very joyful, actually. Like, people weren't expecting to be able to ever eat some stuff again, and now it's edible again, so they're very happy, actually.
They've even included a vegan version of the Dutch classic snack, bitterballen, a deep-fried ball of cheesy ragu flecked with meat. Their bitterballen, however, is made with beans. Pepijn believes that serving recognizable traditional dishes helps to gently ease consumers into a less animal-reliant diet.
We're very cheese culture and meat eating and very indulgent culture as well. We eat what we like, and it's just like the way of life. I think people are just now realizing that it can be good food and it can be very nice to eat and easy to make yourself, and it doesn't have to mean you switching your entire life. So I think that's one of the things why we're doing so well.
The big four?
Shall I take log and then you can take...
And vegan junk food bar are not the only ones to realize that many Dutch customers need a bit of help embracing veganism. Over at Mestino V, a plant-based and gluten-free pizzeria, Italian-born owner Novella Mestino is busy chatting to her first customers of the day, a father and daughter.
I'm also vegan.
I don't trust
you. I'm a flexitarian.
Yeah, exactly. I told you.
After opening this spring, Mestino V became the first vegan pizzeria in the Netherlands, and their menu has everything from the classic margarita, with vegan mozzarella, of course, to a love pizza, bursting with fresh veg. She came up with the idea after noticing that many customers at her original restaurant, Mestino, were asking for animal-free options.
Really was a big surprise for me, and that's why we decided to open the second one and to go completely vegan, because the people are demanding, and there are a lot of people that they want more and more. Especially the vegan, they are happy because finally they say, finally we don't have to ask for vegan, but the menu is completely vegan, so they have plenty of choices. So
the dearth of choice for vegans was also something that inspired Alaid and Kersey to start their own restaurant. Mr. and Mrs. Watson opened just last month and has been busy ever since. Their menu also focuses on reinventing familiar, indulgent dishes, but with an emphasis on a gastronomic experience, says Kersey.
Our goal now is to make vegan dining accessible, and that's why we chose comfort food, but we also want to surprise people, so it's not too easy. It's somewhere in between fine dining and simple dishes.
Brunch favourites include a French waffle toast served with date syrup and home-smoked tempeh bacon, and a pulled no-pork pretzel burger with jackfruit, onions and peppers. But their most popular ingredient is something else entirely, as Alaid explains.
Also, we make our own cheeses, and really the cashew roquefort and the cashew brie, and also some other cheeses that are funky. For example, it's a clove and cumin cheese with some pieces of figs in there, which is really popular as well. And now I'm working on a home-smoked cashew almond cheese.
For a nation nuts about the yellow stuff, this is a huge draw, and it's proven so popular that Alaid and Kersey are already looking for more space to set up a production kitchen. So from burgers to pizza to bitterballen, it seems that with the help of a little bit of creative packaging, the Dutch are increasingly happy to give up their meat and cheese, at least for a few meals a week. For Monocle in Amsterdam, I'm Venetia Rainey.
Well, there's more food and drink stories in The Menu, which premieres at 19:00 London time tomorrow here on Monocle 24. We'll take a look at some of the big stories across Asia in just a moment.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
Monocle has bureau around the world in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Toronto, our bureau chief is Thomas Lewis.
Torontonians like to think of this place as one of the most diverse and one of the most tolerant anywhere in Canada, if not anywhere in the world. And the energy that brings off, I think, is really fertile ground for a journalist, a bureau chief, for Monocle as a whole to tap into and to play a key part in.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
Well, let's take a look now at some of the big stories across Asia. My guest in the studio, John Everard, a former British ambassador to North Korea, who has had another busy week. John, the North Korean foreign minister has responded to Donald Trump's comments earlier this week at the UN General Assembly.
Yes, that's right. Saying that, in not particularly polite terms, that the North Koreans are not going to be shocked and awed by what Donald Trump has said. Specifically, that it would be a dog's dream if he thought that they were going to be dissuaded by this barking of a dog, which sounds about as strange in Korean as it does in English. Talking about dogs in Korea, it's quite an impolite thing to do. Nevertheless, in the context of North Korean rhetoric, it's fairly mild stuff. And what he was saying was that they'll just shrug this off and they will continue. Rather nicely, too, he was asked what he thought of the Donald Trump's remark that Kim Jong-un is Rocket Man, and he said, "I'm sorry for his AIDS," which I thought was quite a sensible thing to say. Ri Yong-ho, of course, we know well. He used to be North Korean ambassador to London. He's level-headed, very clever, very well-connected, and probably has rather more brain power than Donald Trump does.
What we're now waiting for, of course, is any reaction to these new sanctions that the Trump administration's announced.
Yes, that's right. The North Koreans have not so far reacted. Nor, for that matter, have the Chinese, who, of course, are rather more directly affected by what he's proposed. I suspect that something like this, they won't produce an instant reaction, that the Politburo will go into session, they'll chew this over, and that we'll get statements possibly out in North Korean newspapers up tomorrow morning, but not quite yet. Don't be thinking about it.
We were discussing a little earlier Donald Trump's seemingly moving towards wanting to scrap the nuclear deal with Iran. And one thing we talked about with someone in New York was whether anyone is thinking in the White House what signal that sends to North Korea, that on the one hand you're saying you must come to the table and negotiate, while on the other hand saying, but if we don't like the deal, we might just throw it in the bin anyway.
Yes, absolutely. And a lot of the North Korea experts around Washington have been saying precisely this, that firstly, scrapping the Iran nuclear deal is a foolish thing to do in its own terms, but more widely, signalling that deals you do with the United States might just get ripped up, doesn't help U.S. negotiators, in negotiating a nuclear deal with North Korea, if you were able to do that. But more generally, I mean, who is going to invest the time, the effort, and often the money in doing deals with America when you've got people like Donald Trump just going around destroying them?
Now let's move to Sri Lanka, where we're starting to learn quite a lot now about this adoption scandal.
Yes, that's right. Listeners may remember the 1987 shock scandal where they discovered a baby farm in Sri Lanka, 20 newborn babies, 22 women held in a kind of prison, a 3-meter wall, a breeding center. I mean, it was really quite creepy. And at that point, the Sri Lankans banned further adoption by Europeans of Sri Lankan babies. feeling that the whole thing had just got completely out of hand and there was clearly too much of a racket going on. Now, a Dutch documentary has dug a bit deeper into this, and I think it's now clear that the baby farm itself was a horrible story, but that was just the tip of an iceberg. They revealed a complex network of forged documents, babies attributed to women who were not actually related to them at all. Quite a lot of abductions of babies from hospitals, mothers being told that their babies had died shortly after childbirth, whereas in fact the baby was perfectly healthy, it's just that the hospital staff had sold it. Something like 11,000 Sri Lankan babies were adopted by almost entirely Europeans, some North Americans, but most Europeans in the 1980s, 4,000 in the Netherlands alone. And it's clear from this scandal that there's a crying need now to create a database, a DNA database, to allow birth mothers to be reunited with their babies. Many of the babies taken from them in circumstances which you couldn't possibly defend. And to his credit, Rajitha Sarnatne, the Sri Lankan Minister of Health, has said he will do just that. So I think this story will run, and I suspect that as more mothers come forward, we'll discover just how bad the situation was.
Inevitably, when you talk about this kind of number of babies over this kind of time scale, you then have to assume that somebody somewhere has tried to raise the alarm and hasn't seen any action follow.
Well, there's no real indication that anybody has tried to raise the alarm. The Sri Lankans were shocked by the 1987 baby farm story and acted on it. But as far as I can tell, quite genuinely, nobody then, and nobody until the Dutch documentary team started digging around, really understood quite how bad the situation had been, recognising now that the baby farm that they discovered was not the only one. And certainly there were no reports before of the massive forgery of documents that seems to have gone on. Also, it turns out women paid 2,000 rupees, which in 1987 was quite a lot of money, to claim that a baby was theirs, where in fact it wasn't. So you could have a proper handover ceremony from the supposed birth mother to believing and perhaps rather gullible Dutch adopting parents. It really was very well organised and really quite cynical.
Let's move on now to this grenade attack in Kashmir.
Yes, nasty. Of course, Kashmir going through a bad period. We've seen a great deal of violence there, especially since the death of Burhan Wani back in July 2016, who had become something of an iconic figure for the Kashmiri Muslim population in what they regard as a struggle against Indian oppressors. Now, today's attack was in the town of Tral, which of course is where Burhan Wani comes from. He actually lived in a village just outside the town. At a bus shelter in the town, grenades thrown at the cavalcade of the Jammu and Kashmir Minister of Public Works, Naeem Akhtar, who escaped unhurt, but three people were killed. The article I brought you says two. One person has since died. Seven people hurt, including various paramilitaries who were trying to look after the minister. Very sad case. These were innocent bystanders. They probably weren't the targets of whoever threw the grenades. And we still don't know who threw them. The first reaction was that this must be the work of Hizbul Mujahideen, which is the local Islamist group. But they had put out a statement condemning the attack, saying it was dastardly, rather nice word for it. So it probably wasn't them, in which case, who was it?
Just lastly, a reminder that base jumping is a somewhat foolish activity.
Yes, especially if your parachute gets tangled up. Base jumping, jumping off buildings, bridges and so on, so quite low-level parachuting and wingsuit gliding, has rather taken off. And a group of Australians attempted to do a base jump off the tallest building in Sarawak State in Malaysia. Unfortunately, one of the jumps went rather badly wrong. An Australian, just known as Gary, the media hasn't given him a surname yet, rather spectacularly crashed into the side of the building, and there is quite a striking photograph of Gary's legs sticking out of the side of this building, his head of course the other side of the glass, looking really rather in a sad situation. It turns out that he wasn't actually badly hurt, a couple of cuts and bruises, but nothing very serious. He was saved by the fact that his parachute strings were caught up, but a warning that acts of bravado like this, yes, can go quite badly wrong.
So there you are, if you're listening right now thinking that you might indulge in a little base jumping over the weekend and you've changed your mind as a consequence, you have John and I to thank for your continued good health. We'll have to leave it there for now. John Everard, thank you very much for coming in. You're listening to Monocle 24. Well, finally, on tonight's Monocle Daily, we are off to Argentina, where the director, Herman Kral, has been telling the story of one of the country's iconic tango couples, Maria Nieves Reno and Juan Carlos Copes. Our Last Tango is a docudrama about the pair who worked together and were in a relationship, too, before going through a difficult divorce. Well, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to Herman, as well as to Sofia Sevindescalon, who is the film's distributor here in the UK.
Well, Juan Carlos Copes and Maria Nieves are the biggest tango couple of all times. They met at the end of the 40s in Buenos Aires in a milonga. They fell in love for each other and then they continued dancing for almost 50 years together.
And you know dancing when you're young, I believe. So how was it to approach then with the idea for the film?
Well, the first person I met of the couple was Maria Nieves, and I met her at 3 o'clock in the morning outside the milonga. She was smoking a cigarette, and I told her, Maria, I want to make a film about tango. And she told me, okay, come next week to my place. So next week I went to her place and I sat on her sofa, and 30 seconds later I knew that Maria had to be in the film because she's so incredible. But I didn't know how to make the film, if I should have Maria and other protagonists, or I didn't know how to make the film. So what happened was that I read a book by Juan Carlos Copes, and that was the story of his life. And in the story of his life, the love story was very, very important. And when I came across this incredible, tragic and crazy love story, then I knew that the film had to be the love story of Maria and Juan.
I mean, and what a story. I mean, we'll talk a bit more about some scenes of the film and everything, but we have also Sofia here in studio. Sofia, of course, you have a strong involvement with Argentinian cinema. Did you knew the couple as well, even before the film?
No, I didn't. I run the Argentine Film Festival, and this was a film that I saw 2 years ago when it came out in Toronto, and originally I thought about it for the festival because I know that people like tango, but I had a certain resistance to tango because it's what everybody associates with Argentina. So I was like, oh, do we want to do something that's so Argentinian in a way? And then I saw the film and it just completely changed my perspective on tango because it's portrayed in such a beautiful way with the dance scenes, and you know, it's so fresh. It makes tango really, really fresh, and that to me was really special. And I thought, if this film can change my mind about tango, it's a special film. So
I think because the film is not a film about tango.
No.
It's a film about people, about real
people.
Well,
that's true too.
And it's a love story.
Yeah.
And it's packaged somehow, to use this not very kind word, but it's packaged in a tango world, but it's not about tango. I think that was my intention.
No, but I think what I was saying is that you don't have to be a tango fan to enjoy the dance scenes, and I wasn't a tango fan, and this film actually just made me a tango fan in a way, and the dance scenes are so, so spectacular.
It's funny how Maria and Juan, they had very different personalities as well. I think that was fascinating. Of course, and I know they have some, you know, they broke up, so they still have some sort of resentment to each other. What would you say? You've met
some sort of the resentment. They hated each other.
Maybe I'm being a bit too polite here.
One of the most difficult things while making the film was to shoot this scene when they come together on stage. I think I drank hundreds and hundreds of liters of coffee with Juan Carlos until I convinced him to shoot this scene that was pure dynamite. Yeah. But we managed to shoot that with both of them. Yes, it was a very, very powerful relationship. I mean, they hated and loved each other and for many years.
Yeah. Maybe it's just my impression, but she does come across on screen as a bit more likable than him in some ways. You know, maybe you can understand her story, what the struggles that she's been to. Perhaps he was a bit of a perfectionist in some ways, but maybe it's just my opinion. Do you have an opinion here, Toyo? Or, you know?
Well, you know, Maria is very, very incredibly charming person, and she's a wonderful woman, and she's, yeah, as I said, very charming, very generous, very charismatic, extremely intelligent. She's, I think, the most intelligent and the best interview partner I ever had. And she quit school when she was 11 years old because she had to work. And you know, Juan Carlos Copes was born 1931 in the outskirts of Buenos Aires in a very machistic society. So you have to take in consideration these things when you examine his personality, so to speak. Yeah, but I liked him also very much, and I'm very grateful to him because he has a difficult role in the film and in their story, and he was very supportive to the film. So I am very grateful that he was part of it.
And Hermo, what's your personal connection with tango? Did you enjoy the rhythm, or again, it came as a surprise when you were doing the film? Are you a tango dancer, for example?
Well, you know, I have been living in Germany, in Munich, for almost 26 years now. So I left Buenos Aires when I was 22. And, you know, when I came to Germany, I first started to listen to tango in a conscious way. And since then, tango has been having a very important role in my life because it's a kind of bridge for me between Germany, where I live, and Buenos Aires, the city I have in my heart. So tango, I just love tango.
Yo no era celosa.
A question for both of you. How did the film was received outside Argentina? Because, of course, in Argentina, people have, you know, they know this couple, they have opinions on them. But perhaps, Sofia, how do you see, especially because you're also helping to distribute the film?
Yeah, well, the film's been released in, is it 30 countries already?
Right.
So it's been released all over the world. And this is actually one of the last places. It came out in Spain a couple of weeks ago. And the UK is the, yeah, it's been nearly 2 years since it premiered, I think, in Toronto.
With fantastic reviews, I must add, as well.
Yeah, no, the reviews are great, but it's because the story is such a human story, and I think people really connect with that. You know, the love, the hate, the trying to maintain a relationship, trying to work together, being passionate about what you're doing, you know, being passionate about the dance. They were so dedicated to the dance as well. There's a lot of things that people can relate to. It's very universal. And the characters are so warm, you know, you can't help but feel drawn to them and involved in them. So that's, I think that's why the film kind of transcends any kind of cultural barriers in a way. It's a very universal thing that it has.
What about in the country that you're living at the moment, Hermann?
I'm Germany. Living in Germany, and as I told you, Germany was the country where the film was most successful. 5 times more than in Buenos Aires.
Wow.
Yeah, or in Argentina. Yeah, the reason is that tango in Argentina is something that you have it everywhere, every day. So it's not special. And people are very worried in Argentina, you know, politics and money and, you know, don't have time to go to the cinema. And in Germany, where tango is also not popular, but important, we had our most successful release.
And I want to know, because, you know, I know you few films, you always touch in the topic of music. I believe you did something similar with in Cuba as well.
Right.
Musica Cubana,
not
correct?
Similar, but I did have a film which had music in. Yeah, right. Yeah.
What's your upcoming projects? You know, I can imagine something samba in Brazil or something like that.
That would be great.
That would be a good one.
Yeah.
My next project is a project in Argentina. There was a very difficult time at the end of 2001 when people couldn't take their money from their own bank accounts. That was called Corralito. It was the biggest economic crisis Argentina had. And I'm working in a story, and it's a social comedy set in those time. And the models are two British films, Full Monty and Breast Off, films that I love.
That's the film director, Hermann Krall, speaking about Our Last Tango, out tomorrow in UK cinemas. It's already been released across Europe and Latin America. That wraps up this edition of The Monocle Daily, produced by Henry Rhys Sheridan. Our researchers were Daphne Kanisis and Sophia Amadi. Our studio manager was Claire Urban. The Globalist here 8 hours from now, 7 a.m. London time, with Georgina Godwin in the chair. And this programme, The Monocle Daily, returns at 2200 in London tomorrow evening. For the moment, though, from me, Paul Osborne, thanks very much for listening, and goodbye.